I think it's really interesting. It's certainly going to interest me that this third case study is about the collaboration, how it's going and where it's going.
John.
Thank you, David. We did not, when we planned this event, we did not anticipate talking about our own story. And this has been substituted for the cancellation of the speaker I mentioned earlier this morning. And that would have also brought a better gender balance to the day, so I apologize for that in advance. I did apply for a sex change operation, but I'm on the wait list.
three years.
Yeah. The merit of going through this story is that although most of you know the early part of it, and something like three quarters of the people here have actually met with us at one point or another, and half of the people here today have been part of the process. So I won't go into great detail about the process today, but it was useful for Sally and I to think a bit about where we're at now, because it raises questions very germane to the conversation we've been having all morning, which is you get to a point where you think you've pulled together a statement of the evidence, and then you have to figure out whether you're at a point in the policy process when the window's open for that, or is that window closed, and in fact maybe all there is time to do is influence an evaluation of a policy or program that's going to go ahead anyway. So we'll come back to that. The mission for the collaboration was pretty much firm when I was brought from Canada in 2008, indeed when I was interviewed in the spring of 2007. And it is fairly transparent. The focus is therefore, as you can see by this first mission statement, on developing intervention research capacity. And that would speak to disease prevention and control at the population level. The focus never been on clinical interventions or NHS service interventions. My own view as a Canadian is that the NHS, compared to the Canadian healthcare system, which is identically funded from general taxation, is got quite sufficient numbers of managers, planners, and evaluators, and I don't know that I could add anything. So I'm quite relieved not to have to do that. The idea of collaboration has been implicit in this morning's presentation. Our partners typically would be government at all levels, although I don't think we have much impact in Whitehall, and don't expect to. But we certainly are working actively with local authorities in Scotland who carry a lot of the burden of program delivery relevant to public health, as well as the SG level. The research community, which is actually extraordinarily dense for a country of 5 million people, it's amazing to me that there are so many experts in various aspects of public health, something in the range of a few hundred people who have global recognition in terms of their expertise. And of course, the public health community, which includes practitioners, managers, and programs, and so forth. Lastly, there's a long-term capacity issue, which is to try and make sure if we don't survive a five-year review, which is now 3 years of the way, that some kind of institutionalization of this function or the valuable parts of this function remain. And that, I don't know the answer to that one yet, but we'll come back to it perhaps at the end. So we did, in this very room, bring 70 or so public health experts from all of those constituencies I just mentioned, academic, non-academic, high-level policy, frontline practitioners, to the workshop a year ago, January. We structured the workshop so people chose a section of the life course before they came that they would join the breakout group for. They were also led through an electronic survey process to shortlist promising categories of health problems that they thought there were probably effective interventions to prevent or control in a public health sense, but which hadn't been fully applied in Scotland. In other words, there was definite room for application of existing knowledge. Over the subsequent several months, the working groups met twice, by the fall of last year had begun to be able to lay out a work program together with staff. Our staff work together with them, and I'll come to what's in those work programs on the next slide. So What's a key outcome which is not final? I mean, the final outcome would be evidence informed. That's a better term than evidence based, I think. Evidence informed policy change, program change in public health in Scotland. That's great. But in a 3 or 4 or 5 year period, what could we reasonably hope? Well, one key sign that will have to be delivered on, one key outcome at the intermediary level, is that there would need to be some intervention study grants submitted to major funders, and that my dream would be those would be coming from consortia of researchers and research users, which is an ideal, and it's very similar to the model articulated by Alan earlier. We felt very chuffed up that more than half the people who came to the original workshop stayed on, elected. They were given the option of staying involved as members of an actual formal working group in meetings that began last April, a year ago now, of the working groups. And they went back through the short list of promising areas for intervention development or application in Scotland, each of the life course stages that you saw. And then there was sometimes quite active and not simple discussion about which one to work on first, because that's a dicey question. It's not just about burden of illness, that's one criterion. It's not just about how promising the international evidence is that you can reduce the burden. It's useful, but that's not the final story. It's not just about whether you think those interventions that have been found effective elsewhere could be adapted and sustained here. That's useful, but it's not the whole thing. It's also, and this is where you need judgment, you need a lot of people in the room from different perspectives, it's also whether you think it would be done. Would it be done in Scotland in the next 5 years, 3 years? Would something happen? Would there be all of the ingredients for the cuisine that you heard the speakers describe this morning, successful cuisine in the case of the smoking ban? Not sure whether you've got successful cuisine in the case of alcohol in the kitchen. Probably the jury's out. This is the process the working groups went through. I won't go through great detail. We have documentation of all of that, as we're going to need to present for our own evaluation in due course. But we did find, and this last point is that sometimes we would have an aha moment when people in the room suddenly saw that they'd been working in the same area for a long time in a fairly small country, and they had not actually had any chance to compare notes about a policy arena. So this most notably happened around the Early Years Framework, which is a major Scottish policy initiative. And at one point in a presentation by the education sector spokesperson, a policy analyst of quite sophisticated policy analyst, he began to describe elements of that policy. And people who were from the health sector around the table quickly had to put up their hands and say they didn't follow him at all. He was using acronyms they'd never heard of. There'd never been a meeting where people from health and education talked about the early years framework in any sort of a practical, applied sense. So I'm not saying that led to a specific action by that working group, but it was a useful moment, and it's helped us, I think, realize that we need to move forward, to always get those people at the table. And those two sectors, education and health, they have an uneasy and complicated history. They're juggernauts in government, and they both have a world of internal processes and expertise which often never moves outside the silo of the sector. And yet, if you stop and ask yourself if you're going to do anything much in early life without involving both of those around the determinants of health, the answer would be no. You need at least those ministries and child and family as well. So the typical type of work plan content that each working group is still in the process of developing. First and foremost, there's this idea of an environmental scan, which is more than a literature review. It includes review at the level, to the extent that we've been able, of reviews of reviews. Why? Because when you take any of the topics that I'm going to show you, one for each working group, each life course stage, the first hit rate you get for primary studies is typically around 10,000. Okay. So if you go look at obesity interventions for adult life or for childhood, as Hilary Cowie knows, has been working on the EDFIS project for obesity in children, environmental aspects of obesity, that's a typical hit rate. So, you know, by the time you sift through it, you're still going to have usually more than 1,000 relevant key papers worth taking apart, critically appraising for quality. So we saw quickly that we needed to use reviews of reviews approach and rate, quality rate, the reviews that we found, and then fill in the bits that weren't covered in the reviews, more recent primary studies that changed the field because they were immensely conclusive. You have to read some primary studies. But we also have, in each of the scans, although in some cases we split the work, and we're having somebody else work on the scans, policy analysis. We have an analysis of where Scottish policy has got to now. What's been happening? And therefore, how open is the window for this kind of intervention? I'll give you an example in a minute, in case of obesity, the obesogenic environment. We also had a call, not open call to all academics in Scotland, but a call to anyone affiliated with a working group. Why? Because there already is an open grants program at the CSO. Peter's here. He's quick to point out that there was no point in replicating that. Our job was to have seed grants, maximum £20,000 a year for 2 years. So they're quite small. The seed grants are designed to support the working group's list of priorities in terms of problems worth working on developing or adapting global interventions to the Scottish context. So it's a very focused, strategic grants program. And we've had 7 grants peer-reviewed, and they're pretty much all started this month. Money's out the door, which is great. A part and parcel of what we fund in a small way is also improved monitoring and measurement of population health status, particularly using record linkage, which, although sophisticated in Scotland compared to England, still not optimal and still could benefit from increased linkage across administrative data sets in different public sectors. So, for example, most of the record linkage in Scotland doesn't go outside of health and vital statistics yet. There's more and more, I think you're going to see more linkage to education and eventually to criminal justice, social welfare data sets, so we have a more fulsome picture of all the sources of human misery in the average Scottish family's life, which, to be honest with you, the vast bulk of human misery is no longer related until the elderly stage of life to disease. It's actually not. Most of the misery is related to other stuff. Loss of job, loss of house, divorce, separation, child seizure by the authorities. This is the stuff that really is the burden of both untoward experience, but also has its own mental and physical health consequences. So that's a dream, and we support that through work with various people, including SHIP and the Scottish Centre for Longitudinal Studies at the General Registry Office, where we actually have some commissioned work going on. We're very keen that all development of improved Scottish population health monitoring increase the capacity to analyze socioeconomic disparities in health status. That's a crucial part of the mandate. It was set up that way. I wouldn't have taken the job if that wasn't true. This was a health improvement job alone, without regard to the inequalities in health. I wouldn't have taken the job. What? Why would I? It's just a standard public health job. This is a unique opportunity. Scotland does a good job of measuring health inequalities. It's still improve. We still don't have very good measures of the functionality, for example. Rachel Woods here, she can talk to you about this. We still don't have measures of the functionality or the development status, human development status of children after about 6 to 8 weeks of age. Not on the vast bulk of kids who don't get hospitalized or die each year. 95% plus of each birth cohort is not captured in the routine collected child health indicators, hospitalization, death. Yeah, so moving on quickly, we have actually got 4 fellows competitively hired, MRC, CSO development, career development fellows. We have an internship coming this summer and with MRC funding, and we have an attachment of Martin Higgins from Alison McCallum's department. So this is a typical working group portfolio, and in the case of early life, and our fellow who's just completed the scan with input from the working group and peer reviewers internationally, Dr. Rosemary Geddes is here. You can put your hand up. You can talk to her at the break. She's done a review of interventions to promote cognitive and social development in children in that period before primary school. And other areas that are being actively pursued, these would be the topics of grants. I won't read through those, but there are people, some of them in this room, who have grants to work on that. In terms of the kind of data collection that we think would improve the measurement of functionality across the early life period, we're starting by trying to convince a few local councils to pilot the early development instrument. which was developing cannabis, being used in all school enterers in Australia as of this year. We're in touch with those people. It's a big job to convince local councils at this point in history to do anything but that requires effort or money. They are in a catastrophic financial squeeze, and we're finding it quite a challenge, but we're working on that. This is the one for young adults, and Carolyn Jackson is here in the purple, and she's happy to talk to you about her scan. It's just reaching completion stage, and will be reviewed by the working group when we have an international expert, David Hawkins, come to talk about the programs he's used at the community level to change risky behaviors, more than one, in youth in Seattle later in May, actually. And there are a couple of grants, and you may recognize the topics as those that are the favorite topics of certain individuals in the public health community in Scotland. That's because they got the act together and put in a little application to us. This is the adult one. We've just had a meeting to look at the first draft of the scan by John Mooney, our fellow working on this. And it is a massive and diverse literature with many, many disciplines involved. It's a very difficult literature to get your head around. And we have a couple projects which are under development. And lastly, in late life, this is much more of an overlapping project between primary care and public health, because those are the people who fill up primary care offices, the elderly. And so they have a lot of contact with primary care. We have some distinguished professors of general practice, Graham Watt, Kate O'Donnell, Frank Sullivan, working with us on this working group. Because I think whatever solution we come up with, it would have to take advantage of the very strong base in general practice in the UK, in Scotland, for research. I won't read through the rest of these. We have some pilots that we're trying to work on. So that's the work. That's the nature of the work. It's in process, and it's multifaceted. But I just wanted to show you a tool. And I won't read every line of this. This is actually a published tool for summarizing the evidence. This happens to be filled in notionally. I don't want to try to justify the assignments of these obesity interventions. But this is John's work in progress. And what this tool, it's called the portfolio matrix, and it's a way of summarizing evidence across a whole literature about interventions of diverse types, in this case related to the obesogenic aspects of the environment for adults. And so inside the cell, you see the category of intervention, and the column headings are impact, but not just in the sense of effect size, meaning relative risk reduction in the individuals in a trial. Instead, this implies as well the prevalence in the population of the risk factor that you alter in the case of preventive interventions. So it's more akin to population attributable risk if you're an epidemiologist. It therefore has to include a sense of population level impact. What's tricky about it is that optimal potential impact in an ideal society from the literature, or is it Scotland now? And my view is that in order to make an assessment of what the potential impact of an intervention would be in Scotland now, you don't ask just experts, you ask a wide variety of people, because it's a social judgment. And we're going to try and do that through workshop processes to the extent we can. The left side is much more traditional. It's about, do you believe the effect is causal? What's the certainty with which you believe the effect is causal? And it's more of an internal validity problem. It's rarely critical unless it's extremely convincing, or on the other end, not at all convincing, in which case we're used to that kind of judgment. So in the case of not just obesity in adults, but obesity in children, because we'd like to do this with the EDFIS scheme, as Hillary knows, we'd like to help the government decision makers with a decision-making process, a prioritization process within all those possible interventions for obesity, many of which overlap across the life course stages, which would explicitly allow participants, perhaps some hundreds, to take Alan's example, to explicitly weight not only what they thought the impact would be of a particular policy or program, but how likely it would be to be supported by decision makers, invested in, affordable, sustainably affordable, complied with, if that's part of the requirement for the intervention to work in Scotland now. That would require additional data collection, of course, wouldn't it? It would mean focus groups, market research, and so forth. So we're thinking about that, and thinking about using a process not totally unlike our initial workshop to bring consensus, to utilize electronic methods of consultation prior to a meeting to actually bring some prior consensus and then finish through in a Delphi-like process. whether it's possible, whether it's desirable, and what the timing should be, that's the tricky bit. At what point does government want that? Because, you know, once they've got it, they have to bury it if they don't do something. Right? So it's not so easy for government to make that decision about when it wants somebody to help with that process. I think I'll stop. We are trying to evaluate or plan the evaluation of what we're doing. And I'll just indicate to you, because I don't have time to go into detail, that we've got a logic model which, as you'd expect, has a lot of proximal and intermediary outcomes. Because if it's all to be judged, if everything we do is to be judged by whether Scotland's health improves, you know, I should get on the plane now. Lots of other people have dashed their head against that wall. So I don't know that we can expect that in 5 years. But there are, I think, a valid suite of indicators of movement in the right direction around influencing the policy process with science. And we even have a set of indicators that correspond to points in the logic model, as is, of course, required. So I think I've made the points. I won't go through them of what our model consists of. Some of it's implicit. But you can see that it's a test. This is a test of a model which is not proven. I can't go to another jurisdiction and show you that this model has actually changed the way public policies or determinants of health policies are made or implemented. I can't do that. And if you know of another jurisdiction where you think this is an active process, you let me know, and I'd like to go and have a chat with them. I would not say this is true in Canada. Alan can comment. That's why I'm here. We've learned some lessons. I won't go through those in great detail. The biggest challenge is keeping in touch with top-level policymakers whose date books are not in their control, so they can't make your working group meeting. You have to go and have short meetings with them, one-on-one, two-on-two, three-on-three, and go through what you're finding and keep them in abreast of what your investigations, for example, the literature review, are showing. And you have to be in dialogue with them because their world continues like that. So if you're still out there doing what they thought was important last year and you haven't talked to them since, you know, you may have a few surprises in store. But it is a wonderful time to be working in Scotland under devolution at this point, and I take the long view. I'm an optimist. Thank you.
All right, let's have a quick break for some coffee, and we'll come back and we'll have the session. Thank you.